Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It was interesting to witness all of the hubbub around the what was called Four Blood Moons and how many doomsdayers there were saying that the world was going to come to an end, or, you know, that would be the second coming, or Armageddon was going to commence when we had the fourth of the Four Blood Moons that occurred this year. And, you know, in reality, the fact of the matter is that full eclipses are very common. The only thing that isn't really common is a full eclipse with a what's called a supermoon, where the moon is about 10% larger visually than it would normally be. It's only 10% larger because it, you know, the orbit of the moon around the Earth is elongated, and therefore there's times where the moon is a little closer to us, a little further away. So a supermoon, the moon's going to appear about 10% larger than it would on average. And a blood moon is simply a full eclipse. Every full eclipse is a blood moon. It's a blood moon because of the bending of the longer wavelengths of the sun's light as it curves around and through the Earth's atmosphere. There's a little bit of play in terms of relativity and the fact that gravity is an effect, not a force, and the warping fact of lights is a little bit of that, but mostly just the curvature through our atmosphere. Very much like if you look at something that's underwater and you think that you know where it is, you know, but it's actually because of the bending of light as it goes through the fluid, it's actually, in many cases, could be an inch or a foot from where you think it is, where it appears to be. That's how light is bent as it goes through the Earth's atmosphere. But anyway, these people were forecasting all sorts of wild stuff. We made a whole series of shows on exposing and condemning the book called The Four Blood Moons and exposing them as an absolute farce. But nothing happened. Now, something is going to happen. It is going to happen in 2033. That's the next supermoon where there is a blood moon and a full eclipse. It happens to be on the celebration of Sukkah in 2033, which is year 6000. Yeah, that is actually going to be an important date. Now, it's not a doom and gloom date. Sukkah starts the millennial Shabbat, starts 1,000 years where the earth is going to be remade into the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. So the tiny little bit that was Eden, this protective enclosure, which is now under the crystal blue waters of Lake Van in eastern Turkey, that is going to encompass the entire Earth. And so all of the planet is going to be transformed into those same conditions that were experienced at Eden, which means there'll be no religion, there'll be no politics, there'll be no human institutions of any kind. There will be just individuals, people who have been part of the covenant and God. No intermediaries, no priests, no religion, no nothing other than he and his family. And here for 1,000 years, which means all religious artifacts, all political artifacts, all militaries, all judicial systems are just gone. And that is a celebration, really. It's a time, in fact, yeah, we use the term chag to describe it as a party, as a festival feast for 1,000 years. And at the end of that, what we get is a situation where Eden is the entire universe. The entire universe is transformed into the very conditions that were found in Eden. So we go from the Garden of Eden to the entire Earth to the entire universe, ever expanding, just as we will then go from a finite period of time to a larger period of time, 7,000 years on this planet, of humans interacting with God, up to infinity. So it is important that we understand that God did tell us a great deal about that time, about the time that he's going to return, which will be 5 days before Sukkah on Yom Kippurim, on the Day of Reconciliations. He's told us about his relationship with his chosen people on that day, as well as with the Goyim, which would be the Christian church. It would be secular, socialist, secular humanists. It would be those who have engaged in politics and religion. So the scene is set, the timing is set, and I want to spend the next few days actually talking about what God revealed. Because Christians will try to take the Olivet Discourse out of context and take snippets from it to try to ascertain when things are going to happen, not realizing that the preponderance of the Olivet Discourse, which is the second largest, longest dissertation from Yahusha, is actually a recitation of Zechariah, of Zechariah 13:1, which is Zechariah. Zechariah means remember Yahweh, beginning the first verse of the 13th chapter. So we're going to go through what he was citing in the original language so that we might know what is going to occur. It begins. The world's people and nations, the races and kingdoms shall mourn. Families by themselves, the house of Dod, David, by itself, the house of Nathan by itself, their wives by themselves. The world's going to come together as a one world order, and then it's going to be fragmented. And as it's fragmented, what we're going to see is a total separation between Israel and the rest of the world. And it's a time of mourning. The 7 years that lead up to year 6,000 Yah. The year 6,000 Yah is exactly 2,000 years or 40 Yobel from the time that the first Moed Mikre were fulfilled. That would be year 4,000 Yah, which is 2033 in our pagan, or 33 CE in our pagan calendars, meaning the year 6,000 Yah is 2033. So this is the end of the tribulation. It is a time of worldwide mourning. A tribulation will begin in 2026 and continue to 2033. The people and nations of the world shall mourn. And I will pour out, while that is occurring, Yahweh says, I will pour out on the household of Dod, that would be David, that would be love, that is Israel, particularly Yahuda, Judah. And on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the Hebrew word Jerusalem is based on the verb yara, which means source from which teaching, guidance, instructions, and direction flow. Yara, according to Yahweh, is the verb that forms the basis of the title Torah. So the Torah, which would be the instruction that Yahweh passed on to us through Moshe during the Exodus, is based on this verb that is the basis of the name of his favorite city. Yara for Yerushalem. Shalom is the second part of Yerushalem, so it would be the source from which teaching and guidance and direction regarding shalom, which is reconciliation, restoration, reaffirmation, flows. So Yahweh says he will pour out on the home, the household of Dod, of David, and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of acceptance, a spirit which pleads for favor. On that day there shall be a source opened for the household of Dod, of David, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem concerning the offer to purify and cleanse all corruption. So, Yahweh has told us that he's going to reconcile his relationship with the chosen people. It's a promise that he made to Abraham. It's a promise he makes over and over again to Yishak, Isaac, to Jacob, who was renamed Yisrael. And he has told us prophetically that he's going to reconcile that relationship. He divorced them formally in the book of Hosea, where the northern kingdom in particular had chosen to be political and religious, and therefore they were divorced for infidelity, for adultery. And he says, you are no longer my children. But then he tells them prophetically in that same book that there will be a day where they will become his children again, that there'll be 2,000 years from the time of the healing to the time of the reconciliation, which speaks of the time from 33 CE to 2033, and he's going to reconcile his relationship. It's emblazoned in the 31st chapter of of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, where he says that he is going to reconcile and reaffirm his covenant relationship with Yahudah and with Yisrael. And that is what he's speaking out here. To facilitate this, he's pouring out a spirit of reconciliation. A source is being opened for the inhabitants of Dod, of Yisrael, of particularly Yahudah, concerning his offer to purify and cleanse them of corruption. And it shall exist on that day, declares Yahweh, of the assembled conscripts of Shaba, the command and control regimen. The names of the idols made of the substance of the earth will be cut off, will be banished, ceasing to exist, recalled and proclaimed and remembered no more. So here Yahweh is reinforcing something that should be obvious but is completely unknown to those who are religious. That the names of the religious gods are an abomination to the one true God. The name Jesus, the name Allah, the name Shiva, the name Lord are all hated by Yahweh. And when he is pouring out this spirit of acceptance, the very first thing that will occur is that they will no longer speak of false gods. That's why the first of the 10 statements says, I am Yahweh, your God. And it concludes with, you shall not exist with any other gods in my presence. So, and then in between those two statements, he says, I'm the one that led you away from being slaves in Mitzrayim, in the crucible of human oppression. So he's telling us that he is our liberator, that he frees us from slavery to human institutions, that his name is Yahweh, that Yahweh alone is God, and that if we wish to exist on an ongoing basis, we can have no other gods in his presence. Here he's reinforcing that, saying simply, the very first thing that's going to occur when he pours out the spirit of reconciliation, the spirit of purging us of corruption, is that we will be purged of, forever distanced from, all of the false names attributed to God. Jesus, Christ, Lord, Allah, Shiva, et al. They're all going to disappear, never to be spoken or heard of again. It was, it is, it will be on that day, declares Yahweh. So Yahweh is announcing under his own name that the names of the idols made with the substance of the earth. Let's think of some of the names of the idols made with the substance of the earth. You've got Allah, which is the represented by the black stone in the midst of the stone pile known as the Kaaba. You've got in Christianity all the statues to Mary. In fact, all the statues to Mary and the crucifixes, you know, the Christian cross, all represent idols, objects of worship, images of reverence made of the substance of the earth. All of that's going to go away. Not only that, the objects themselves, but the names that are used to convey them. And you even look at the buildings. The churches, all made of stone and covered in the metals of the objects of the earth, places of reverence, they will no longer exist. And you know, the church is a pagan concept. It's there's no reference to a church anywhere in Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and even in the so-called Christian New Testament. The word that has been changed to church is ekklesia, and ekklesia is a translation of the Hebrew word that was actually spoken, which is mikra, which is invitations to be called out and to meet with God. There are seven of them, of which Sukkah is the seventh. And church is simply the transliteration of the daughter of the sun. Church was the daughter of Helios in the Germanic religion. So all of these things are going to be going to cease to exist. And it's interesting that God used karat. Karat means to cut. And you can, you know, a cut goes both ways. You can be cut off or you can be cut in. And so most of the terms that Yah uses related to the covenant, for example, the covenant is cut. So you are, it's cut in the way that you would cut a deal in business. The way that you would cut the party with whom the deal is being formed into the deal, but that deal then excludes other parties. It creates a unique relationship between the parties that are cut into the deal. But as in all things, a cut works both ways. It separates. You can be on one side or the other of the divide. And so in this particular case, he's using karat to speak of cut off, to be separated from. And they'll be remembered and proclaimed no more. That's the interesting thing about heaven, is it would be a hellish place for a religious individual. There'd be no more Allah. You can't bow down and pray. There'd be no more prayer, no more prostration, no more bowing down, no more worship, no more religious hymns. None of that stuff will exist in heaven. There'll be no Jesus. There'll be no Christ. There'll be no Lord there as well. And there will be no symbols that have ever been associated by man, created by man, to be associated with God. He goes on to say, "Moreover, I will quickly distance and destroy from the world prophets and the intoxicating spirit of uncleanliness and infidelity." The reason that God hates religion is that people who claim to speak for God lead others away from God. Their words are unclean, their words are intoxicating, and they simply mislead. Rob is called in from Michigan and has either an answer or a question that came up in Monday's show. Hello, Rob.
Hey, how you doing, Craig?
I'd like
to try and answer the question, I guess.
Okay, go ahead. What's the question from Monday's show that you want to address?
You know, there's this thing that's been going on, I think, especially on our Friday night show, where, you know, some people are mentioning non-canonical books and...
Oh, yeah, Enoch and Jubilees.
It's almost like the food thing, you know what I mean? When that we went through the, you know, some people aren't going to eat pork, some people are going to eat pork, whatever.
Yeah, the difference, though, on the food thing, although it blew up when Yahweh and Devarim created an exemption, if you're thoughtful, you can eat anything you want. What it does is it explains that everything that he instructed on food is to be thoughtfully understood so that you know why he said the things that he did and how it relates to you and our relationship with him for your spiritual as well as physical health. But on this other thing, which you'd have to have, Rob, for the claim that there's no calendar in the Torah, and that the only place you can find a calendar is in apocryphal books in Enoch and Jubilees, it would render the Torah a complete hoax, a total and absolute lie. So why would you pay attention to invitations that are in the Torah if the only way that you can honor those invitations was to read a book that changes everything? We'll be back with Rob after the commercial break. Arguments against Enoch and Jubilees are many, but the notion that the Torah does not provide us with a calendar, which is the starting place that the Enochers jump off into it to say, well, there is a calendar in Enoch, so since there's no calendar in the Torah, you need the calendar in Enoch, and you end up with with weeks that are based upon the new moon and all sorts of... I mean, everybody has their own interpretation of what Enoch is presenting. But what I find is the premise is preposterous, that Yahweh would have presented meeting dates that are specific and given us the means to ascertain these meeting dates and use terms to describe his calendar, and yet he didn't have a calendar that we could pay any attention to for 1,000 years. That just sounds preposterous to me.
Does to me too. I'm not really agreeing. I haven't seen the argument. I haven't seen the opposing information, so I really couldn't tell you, you know, what that's all about. But I guess I really wanted to answer Kirk's question.
Okay.
As far as the calendar, I haven't looked into it, so I have no idea. I have no opinion about that. But I'm right as of now, I'm going to follow what the Torah says just to be on the safe side, you know.
Yeah, never can go.
I'm always open to new information, you know.
Yeah, you know, the Torah is complete, lacking nothing. Perfect,
right.
Complete, and lacking nothing, according to Yahweh's inspired account of it. He says, don't add anything to it. Don't take anything away from it. I think that Yahweh is a very effective communicator. I think he provided us with not only a calendar for each year, when the year starts, how we designate the first day of a month, how long a month lasts. So he gave us a calendar to ascertain the solar year and when the solar year starts, based upon the Exodus, gave us a calendar as to when each day starts and concludes, which is at sundown. Gave us a long calendar in the sense of the 7,000 years of human history, from being booted out of the garden to returning to the garden to the new universe being created, and gave us a very specific monthly calendar. And then the weekly calendar with the Shabbat. So he has outlined time for us, and this notion that he didn't provide enough information or a calendar, I just view as absolutely preposterous. How would you follow the Torah's guidance if the Torah didn't provide you any guidance on a calendar?
That's true. We're at the mercy of a lot of translators and scribes, though, because even the oldest, you know, known relics we have or fragments of the Torah are only like, what, 120? Or, I mean, I guess they're saying they're like, there's some earlier ones they found.
Yeah, well, no, the Dead Sea Scrolls, well, first of all, we have fragments that date back down to the 6th and 7th century CE,
yeah.
And we have things chiseled in stone that affirm what occurred back 1,000 and 1,500 BCE that are detailed in the Torah. So there's lots of things that are in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that are affirmed in historical engravings dating back to over 1,000 BCE. And we have sections of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that have been unearthed, typically in precious metals, dating to the 7th century, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, the Qumran Scrolls, date to as far back as 250 BCE.
Right.
So we've got some pretty old texts. And lots
right.
of them.
They're not like 1,500 years old.
No, the original autograph of the Torah would be, yeah, the original autograph of the Torah is 1450 BCE.
1450.
Yeah, I think it exists. I think it is sitting by the Ark of the Covenant in Yirmiyah's grotto, which is directly beneath the Golgotha Bluff of Mount Moriah. Directly now under the Jerusalem parking lot for the Jerusalem bus station is where it is. So I think there is a copy of the Torah that's the original autograph. But you're right. The best we can do is use the oldest extant evidence, which we have a treasure trove in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then rather than being a mercy of translators, we can do our own translation. For example, the way that you know that Yahweh has a lunar month based upon that's aligned with a solar year is you translate his words. And Kodesh, which is the Hebrew word for month, it means a beginning of the month. It's a renewing, in fact, it's renewing of the moon. Based upon Kadash, tells you that it's the renewal of the light on the moon's surface that is the first day of a month. So, not hard to figure out.
No, it's not. I don't know what he must have been there. You know, the Book of Enoch compiles five different writings, so it's hard to say which writing he was reading from. I probably the heavenly luminaries, I assume. Is what part of the book he was
The problem with Enoch in general is that it's first it's falsely attributed. Enoch, you know, preceded the Torah by a very long period of time, and there's no evidence whatsoever that he left us a book. There's no reference to a book of Enoch, and so it's fraudulently attributed to the man. The oldest copies that we have are found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, but they're the history of his compilation goes back to about 200 to 300 BCE, long after Yahweh finished with his prophets. And there's no prophetic proof that the book was inspired by Yahweh, and much of it is craziness. I mean, it's a bunch of stuff in it that's contrary to the Torah, that is just craziness, and no proof that Yahweh...
have you inspired. Read the book?
Yeah, as well as Jubilees. And it's like everything else that pretends to be of God. It intertwines that which is true and that which is false. To have credibility, it usurps Yahweh's credibility. It's just that it adds to what he has to say, it changes, contradicts what he has to say, and when you apply the test that's in Devarim, there's two tests, both presented in Devarim, to ascertain whether or not something is from Yahweh or not. If you apply that test to Enoch, it fails it.
Right. I mean, you'd have to do it to each separate book that's compiled into the one writing, you know.
I don't think so.
You really have to go back to the original.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I
translate them.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I think that it's pulled together as a singular book, and there is no indication that any part of it's true. But the fact is that Yahweh gave us an indication here. They said, you know, if you've got a good tree, it's going to give you all good fruit. And if you've got a bad tree, it's going to give you all bad fruit. And that the book of Enoch is a bad tree. And it's like Paul's writings. Are there some positive things in Paul's writings? Yes, they're few and far between, but there's a few positive things in his writings. But his writings are a bad tree. And so even that which is accurate in it is only there to give credibility to the deception. And the same thing would be true of Enoch. So you can't pick and choose and say, well, I kind of like this, but I don't like that. You have to take it as a whole cloth, and either it's truthful or it's not. Kirk, I know you called in both on this and on Zachariah. What do you think about Enoch?
Well, it's been around a long time. Everybody knows about it. I read it. It's nuts.
I think it's nuts.
I mean, it's totally nuts. I mean, he's got, like I think Larry mentioned one time on one of the shows, you've got angels,
right.
Hawk, marrying women and producing giants and all that sort of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's just nuts.
Yeah,
you know, in fact, Yosha even said, that's nuts. I mean, this whole idea, and he's addressing that, of being a sexual being and having marriage and as a spiritual being. He says, that's nuts.
He dispelled that right away. He said, that's yeah. not what's going on when you become a spiritual
right.
being.
Right. Yeah, that there'd be...
You know,
the whole thing is sheer insanity. There's so much frivolity, just mythology that's woven into it, that it's astonishing that people are wanting to trust it, to believe it.
You know what it does show you, though, is that,
yes.
at least to me, is that how low it was for Yah to come to enter into our life. I mean, I don't think Satan and them would ever even want to be. You know, I know they'll possess a body once in a while, but they won't come down and become a human being to them. They disdain us.
Correct. Yeah, that's really what's interesting is that...
Why would they produce children and be part of this world? You know, they want us to bow to them.
Right, they think they're superior. That was the whole argument that that Satan has. He wants to be greater than the Most High. They think that they're superior. And in many ways, they are superior to humans. So they're more powerful. They're longer lived. And therefore, as an energy-based entity, light entity, they are times the speed of light times the speed of light superior to any physical being. But they were not created with free will, And without free will, you are deprived of so many things that are so enriching and empowering. For example, love and the power of love. And the creativity that comes along with free will. And so that's why God makes it clear. Yeah, there are some ways that they're superior. But overall, because we have free will, and because we were made in Yahweh's image with a conscience, with the ability to ascertain good and bad, to be judgmental, be creative, and just to choose.
Yeah.
We're better than they are.
Well, sure. How would Hala bend your card and go against Yahweh if you didn't have the free will? And
well,
he didn't get to do that.
Yahweh allowed it, but the reason that he could rebel and to make this claim is that he had an immediate consequence for doing it. You know, if you're in the military, you have no free will, but that doesn't mean that you can't refuse an order. But if you refuse an order in the military, what happens is an immediate consequence. You're deprived of your liberty. Sometimes you're even deprived of your life. And so in a non-free will environment, you can still rebel, but there's an immediate penalty associated with it. That means that you don't have free will. You don't have free will in the military. The Shaba, the command and control regimen of spiritual messengers, exactly the same thing. You rebel, there's an immediate consequence because you were not given the freedom to do so. You know, as it relates to Yahweh's Moed, which are appointed meetings, didn't he tell us in the book of Bereshit, the first book, in the first chapter of the first book, that the fourth day was a time where the greater and lesser light, one governing the day, one governing the night, would be signs for the Moed? So doesn't that tell you, since the sun is the determining factor for a solar year, and the lesser light, the moon at night, is the sign for the Kodesh, the months that make up the year, that these things collectively determine the times of the Moed?
That's a pretty good assumption. That's what it seems like it says to me.
Yep.
So why would the argument be that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms don't have a calendar? Why would Yahweh talk about the first month and the seventh month and the days within that month if he didn't establish a calendar?
The Yehudim knew what time it was year-round everywhere they went. They were the most educated people and generally are the most educated people throughout all history. I mean,
what sign at night has a goes through a cycle of renewal of light?
None but the moon.
So when he used this term for renewed light on the moon, Kodesh, to describe his month, how could there be any question as to what the first day of the month is and what a month represents? And you know how many, when he goes through and numbers them, you know how many he numbers? 12.
Mm-hmm. 12 months.
I mean,
clue. That's a clue.
Oh, clue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and when he's talking about his Moed, as he does particularly with Sukkah, he not only uses the Hebrew word for month, Kodesh, which is a based on Kadash, time of renewal, renewed light on the moon's surface, that he specifically says that seven times during the year, going to meet with him. Shana being the year, the Hebrew word for year, also based on the concept of renewal.
He gave him a seven-day week, and he gave him a Yobel every 50. Right. I mean, you got everything planned right out to the...
Right. Yeah, doesn't he also use tell us that the first day of the year is going to be Abib? The first month of the year is takes place in Abib, where the first grain, which is his favorite symbol for saved souls, that the first grain crop, barley, is ripe and growing, and the flax is flowering. that's the time of renewal. That's, we always think of spring as a time of renewal. So he tells us that this shana, this the Hebrew word for year, time of renewal, takes place during the time of renewal. I mean, it doesn't appear complicated to me.
No.
I can tell you that I've been a member of the covenant for about 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed, you know, I've been pretty much going off the moon and doing all the, you know, keeping the parties basically with my family. And the
yes.
Point
yeah,
of time. And I've
same
never
thing.
Felt more complete in my life. I've never felt better. Yeah. And I've had a pretty rough time of it in
yeah.
this world. But regardless, I mean, that's what I've been doing, and it's been really helpful to me.
Yeah, you mentioned something, and I want to go a little bit sideways here for a moment. One of my close friends has a daughter who was born with a number of challenges, and the thing that has been the most helpful to her in her recovery is medicinal cannabis. I know that you are in that that business, and because it made a profound influence on the restoration of your health. Would you mind, Rob, sending me an email at yada@yadaya.com? At Yada, you know, just go to the Yada Yada website, yadaya.com, and the contact us will come to me, or it's just email at yada@yadaya.com, and I'll get the email. Could you send me so I have your email address, because this friend would like to make contact with you on behalf of his daughter?
I'd be more than happy to help him out for sure. That's
yeah.
What,
and for those who don't know what we're talking about, but Rob provided a considerable amount of education on the benefits of cannabis medicinally and the influence that it had on him. And so we have a covenant member, his name is Jerry, who has a precious little daughter who is suffering. And medicinal cannabis has been a lifesaver to her, beyond just helping her. It's been a lifesaver to her. So I would love to get the two of you together to see if you can help one another. Rob, thank you for calling. Kirk, thank you for calling. We'll be with you tomorrow.